On the programme, 30 years of Temple Bar Gallery and Studios in Dublin, Robert Armstrong on his new paintings, and ahead of his Irish gig, American pianist and composer Ahmad Jamal on jazz, America's classical music. And welcome to Arts Tonight. First, to the heart of Dublin and the Temple Bar Gallery and Studios, recently and remarkably 30 years old. To mark that anniversary, the gallery has produced a fine book called Generation, tracing the three decades of growth, development and change in a space that was artist-led and inspired and remains something of a model of artist-centred practice. Later we'll share some memories of the making of the space and its early days with painter Robert Armstrong as he prepares for a new solo exhibition. But first I met outgoing director Claire Power and art critic Aidan Dunn in the building at 4 to 8 Temple Bar and asked Claire Power about the gallery and the studio spaces there.
All the great Irish artists have come through here. And last year we celebrated the 30th anniversary, and the figure that we have for the number of artists is 318 over the 30 years. Artists have kind of come here and built their career here. And I guess what we are really about is like, it's a building that supports artists through the studios, but it's about nurturing that talent and giving artists a kind of comfortable, warm, secure place to work within the city centre is really important. And especially, I think, in somewhere like Temple Bar, that's right in the heart of the city.
Aidan Dunn, a very impressive building, this, and it is amazing to think that it was originally a shirt factory, you know. And I remember this area in the 80s, Nick Miller with the studio around the corner, and this palpable sense of artistic activity. But I don't think anybody could have envisaged something like this emerging from it. I mean, it very much artist-led. Has that remained at the core of the gallery and studios here, you know, that it is really a centre almost for artists by artists?
I think that is true to say. I mean, there's a strong representation of artists on the board at Temple Bar, and that was built into it from the very beginning. And I think a lot of credit is due to Jenny Houghton, who was not the sole founder member, but really, I think, the guiding spirit from the start. And I like the way she said when she began it, she was just back from New York and she was in a New York state of mind. So she brought that kind of breadth of kind of vision to the project. And it was quite daunting because this was a huge building in terms of Temple Bar. People thought of Temple Bar as all these small, kind of very local initiatives on the part of artisans and artists and people doing interesting, quirky things. But her vision was on a much broader reach altogether, and it involved, like, before the building was redone, there were actually 32 spaces in it, which is like, to take on that at that stage with, by the way, no money, was a quite incredible achievement. And so it's a credit to you, but it's also a credit to Jenny in the way that built into the constitution of the organization from the beginning, it hasn't changed to this day. The board is still constituted in exactly the same way as it was then, which I think shows a kind of inspired grasp of how to pragmatically run an organization.
When you look back over the 30 years, and it is hard to believe that it is 30 years, do you have particular memories of shows, of moments that stand out for you that in a way that might have been unexpected and that wouldn't have happened without this building here and without that will again and determination of artists to make something special happen?
Yes, and I think often the shows that really stay in the mind are the surprises, you know, the ones you don't expect at all. And I must say that there are strong international connections between Temple Bar Studios and elsewhere, notably Finland, oddly enough, but it's been incredibly fruitful. I think one of the best shows I've seen here was Sala Tikka, the Finnish artist who's now very well known. She was here when she wasn't that well known quite early on. And her show was really a knockout in terms of the quality of the work, the level of production, and so on. And I think that is something that Temple Bar has done very well, and that is to bring very high-performing artists in and show local artists that they really have to up their game, and they're in this kind of international framework, and they must be very careful about how they go about things. Equally, though, there have been tremendous shows by Irish artists, like Nevin LaHartz was a knockout, Sonia Shields was a knockout, I would say. Shows like that really stay in the mind and they stand out.
Claire, in your introduction to this very handsome publication, Generation, to mark the 30 years of the Gallery and Studios here, you say that in order to envision the future, it's important to look back on our past. What for you are the key elements of that past that can and should influence the future?
I mean, it's kind of following on from what Aidan was saying as well, that there have been many different iterations in a way of TPGNS over the last 30 years, but the message has been a constant, and it is that we are artist-centred, we're artist-focused, that primarily this building and this organisation is about supporting professional artists and artists who work in the city centre. That's incredibly important. The gallery has a contemporary art programme of Irish and international artists, that's a curated programme and kind of, in conversation with what's happening in contemporary art is really important. And I guess what makes here unique as well is the fact that I don't think there's no other gallery in Ireland that has 30 artist studios attached to it as well. So that here is this active site for production is really important, and that's something that we're trying to explore and kind of put to the fore more through the gallery programme as well, through new work commissions and continuing to work with international artists in kind of ambitious ways where we can find extra funding. Like, say, the next exhibition coming up is Priscilla Fernandez, who's a really interesting artist. She's Portuguese, but she studied at the National College of Art and Design. So we're working on her with the Sola New Work Commission, that's also funded by the Mondrian Foundation as well. So it's enabling her to make new work, which is fantastic. This is a cultural organisation. We're a publicly funded organisation. The public is incredibly important. How we are within the city is something we're always thinking about. We have, a community outreach programme that we started last year. Education has always been an ethos of this organisation as well, in terms of trying to connect with a diverse audience, because there's a real core arts audience who will visit our exhibitions, but we're kind of interested in opening up to new audiences as well. So the creative people who live and work in the city, tourists who visit in Temple Bar, and then through our outreach programme, which we started a new programme last year with Mason Hayes and Kern, who are a law firm. They supported us with this programme called Creative Generations, where we're working with children and young people from the Ringsend area and connecting them with the artists in the studios as well.
How do artists apply for and actually get a place here? I mean, I presume that there's competition for it. I'm sure lots of people want to get in here. I mean, is there a particular process for it? Is it difficult?
It's always a difficult selection, because the studios here are really highly sought after. So there's always year on year like a phenomenal level of artists applying. We would do an open call. We receive in maybe 70 applications. We do a shortlisting process, and then we invite a panel. And the panel is comprised of people from outside the organisation, say two like peer assessors, and then people from inside the organisation, myself and Rain, who's the curator, and a board member as well. So for this year, for example, we did our annual studio selection, and we invited Mary Conlon, who's a curator from Ormston House in Limerick, and Mike Fitzpatrick, who is head of the Limerick School of Art and Design there. It was really hard to choose. Yesterday we had another selection panel, and that was for our new recent graduate residency award that we've just advertised before Christmas. We've had some sponsorship support that's enabled us to be able to give a young artist a free studio here for the year, so it's the biggest and best studio in the building. A lot of mentoring support, €1,000 materials grant, and a travel grant as well to encourage young artists to go away and see shows. There's such a really high standard of young artists still working in Ireland, not kind of, I guess, going abroad straight away. And that with this award, we kind of wanted to find a hook for artists, young artists, to stay in Ireland as well.
Aidan, this must be inspirational for young artists. You knowing that this centre is here and that there is the possibility of studio space, it must be important for this new generation of visual artists in Ireland.
It is, and I think it's important as a model as much as for a practical reality, in that there are many group studio schemes now operating throughout the city. I mean, Temple Bar wasn't actually the first, but as a model, an example of how to go about it and how to maintain it, I think it is completely exemplary. I mean, I think there's nothing to compare to it, really. And the fact that it has endured so well and has thrived. And that the quality of every aspect of it as it's gone along is so impressive, like the quality of the building, which you were talking about. That's quite exceptional, because if you go to generally the words group studio strike fear into your heart, because you know you're going to go along and find sort of some dilapidated building with sort of cordoned off into little workspaces, not really inspiring at all. Whereas here, these are professional level studios. And I think that's very important because as Clara was saying, the artists now coming out of college are incredibly impressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that visual arts have reached a very high level among the younger artists in Ireland, more than we would have dreamed of like 20 years ago even. So it's vitally important to have places like this that they can move on to for that intermediate stage before they then get on with their careers.
This publication, Generation, again, you know, a fine record of 30 years. And it's actually very interesting to look at it and think that it is very recent history, and yet bringing it all together reminds you of how significant this achievement is and how recent Temple Bar is. But, you know, something like this in itself then becomes an important document of the visual arts in Ireland.
Yes, it does. And I really like the history, and I like it because it doesn't set out to pin things down and close them off. It's actually a bit like a collage, the book. It has lots of different strands, lots of different things coming into it, and it uses a lot of original material as well. So actually, if you look through carefully, you can find lots of little controversial bits and pieces that, you know, are part of any organization's history along the way, and they're part of Temple Bar as well. Because after all, if you've got a bunch of creative people compressed into one little space, there are going to be sparks flying along the way, and there were.
Robert Armstrong, we're here in Temple Bar Gallery and Studios, which you helped establish in 1983. What was this building before it became what it is now, and what was Temple Bar like before it became the Temple Bar it is now?
Well, Temple Bar at that stage was an unknown part of the city. Most people wouldn't have been able to tell you where it was if you called it Temple Bar.
Now, it's seen, as there was a lot of people look back and say, it was almost a golden time for artists. You know, obviously studio space was cheap, something new was being created, which in turn helped to establish what Temple Bar is today. Was it, in your opinion, was it a better time for artists around Temple Bar then?
Well, it was definitely a heady time. I mean, we were all younger then, for one thing, and everything seemed possible. I mean, we were in our 20s or just hitting our 30s at that stage, and everything was possible, and the kind of economic crisis hadn't happened, none of that, even though we were soon to head into one, but there was a great sense of buoyancy and collaboration. And when this building was set up in the beginning, there were choreographers, there were musicians, there was a restaurant, there was a cinema. So it was like seen as a model of a multi-purpose art center that, funnily enough, over time, it pared itself back to being just simply gallery and studios. But as that was happening, other institutions, other places opened, and they specialized in their own way. And I think as the pendulum has come around again full swing, there's a kind of a sense that younger artists, younger graduates, are setting up new centres with a similar kind of multimedia possibility or potentiality in their minds, you know?
I suppose that there's a certain perception that Temple Bar in general has become somewhat corporate and has moved away quite a bit from those early days and I suppose an artist-led initiative to something that seems more at times about administrators about money to a certain extent. I mean, do you think there's been enough acknowledgement of the role of artists in setting up this area that has become such a heart of the city, even if it is at times associated with now with stag parties and the like?
Yeah, well, I think the book Generation kind of details how the very survival of Temple Bar Gallery and Studios owes itself to being artist-led, and it still is, even though we have become much more professional. You know, we have really good administrators looking after us, we have an independent board, we have all of that, but the artists still have a say, a massive say, and I think that's a really good thing. And despite all the stag parties and despite the commercialization that you're talking about, artists do manage to work here and survive here.
You're working here in your studio at the moment, a new show opening in Dublin shortly. Tell me about the new painting, the new work you're making for this show.
Well, this work carries on from my sort of habitual concerns, mainly looking at traditional classical painting and trying to find new ways to make it relevant, to make it work, and to make it exciting. Painting seems to operate in a way that it's often as much about what's not included as what's on the surface. So what I'm excluding from the work I'm making is any connection to obvious narrative. So while I'm looking at paintings that are loaded in terms of narrative content, I'm focusing more on material quality or on some sort of other aesthetic to do with color, spatial concerns, and looking for ways to also try to make the paintings beautiful in a way. I'm not too afraid to use the word.
Yeah, because some
beautiful.
Artists are. There's almost a fear of beauty, and I can never understand that because I think it at its best, it's a great concept.
Yeah, I think beauty is a noble aspiration. I think in the age that we live in, there is a high value placed on theoretical considerations when it comes to art in general. A lot of contemporary art is fairly theory-driven or driven by ideas and issues. Painting seems to avoid some of that, but not always. And there is a pressure on painters, I think, often to be conceptual. And I remember somebody asking me one time, you know, are there any conceptual painters? And I kind of thought, well, this is a really strange idea because how would anybody begin a painting without having an idea in the first place? So ideas are at the basis of it. And, you know, Marcel Duchamp has a lot to answer for using the phrase dumb as a painter. And painters are not dumb, you know, they think continually about what it is they're engaged with and how better to make it work.
Can we look at one of the paintings that you're working on here? Mm-hmm. And I'm not necessarily going to ask you about titles yet.
Yeah.
But again, you know, in a sense, from your work, some familiar shapes and a familiar surface. This kind of this oil, but hills, mountains, a figure. Wonderful color, these kind of yellows and greens, kind of muted and vibrant somehow at the same time. Tell me a bit more about that painting.
Well, this particular one we're standing in front of is a large-ish painting, and it's about a guy called a Kiribati man, or Kiribati is the name of an island. I think it's pronounced Kiribati. It's an island in the Pacific. And this guy, I read, this is different from the source material for most of my work because it actually comes from a newspaper article I read recently about a guy who is looking for refugee asylum in New Zealand on the basis that the island in the Pacific that he comes from is disappearing through a process of global warming. And the New Zealanders are saying, well, I mean, this... you know, global warming is not some sort of criteria we have on the books for refugee status. So it's a big court case, and I think it's really interesting. And there are photographs of him on the net, but it took me back to paintings I had made before of Renaissance figures with scouts standing on tops of hills while armies are coming in and out. And I love that sort of mountainous landscape that appears very often in Renaissance art where saints and devils and characters appear from behind cliffs and rocks that are a little bit like stage settings where the drama is about to enact. And
There is a sense of theatre in that. I mean, it is as if he's king of the world, but it's king of a disappearing world.
It is, yeah, and it's a bit ambiguous as to whether we're looking at the sea or the sky or the horizon line is a bit blurred. So It's kind of like he is sinking. The world is sinking.
And he really stands out in that red and white and black. And it's a great use of colour.
Yeah. I think that some of the images that we have through the history of painting, they offer a world which is optimistic and, I'm thinking as well of some of those paintings of the American Wild West, you know, in particular, that present a vision of a utopian world. But the kind of vision that we necessarily have of the world now is one of a planet in crisis. You know, so, you know, I mean, I'm not a crazy environmentalist or anything like that, but I am interested in how our view of the landscape is different now from what it was in the 14th century or the 15th century or any other time up to the present.
Is it hard at times to get the balance between that work of teaching and mentoring a younger generation of artists and painters and making your own work?
Well, it's difficult on the one hand, but it's wonderful on the other hand. It's difficult in terms of managing my time because I teach 4 days a week at NCAD, but I'm very rigorous about spending the other 3 days in the studio. So I do that, but as well as that, then there's tremendous energy and talent and vitality coming back from the students who are absolutely magnificent. I mean, they turn up every year bringing fresh ideas and interest to the whole process.
And again, is there as much interest now in painting as ever before? Because I suppose, again, there may be a perception that youngsters are moving towards digital media and conceptual art. But are in general, are they as open to painting as a medium as before?
I think there's even greater interest in painting now. I mean, it's funny. You go to Biennales and you look at the Turner Prize and you kind of think, oh, the one painter there seems like an aberration. It seems like an unusual event. And in the art world in general, there may be a preponderance of video art or other forms, but painting is the one constant. And painting has this peculiar ability to migrate towards other forms. And there's an interesting Dutch writer, Jan Verwoerd, and I was listening to him recently. He was talking about how painting seemed, while the whole history of painting, the whole history of art seems to follow a linear trajectory, he's kind of interested in painting as being moving in a crab-like way, kind of sideways to everything. And I think that painting does that. That's why it has this ability to pick from different areas. And I think this, along with the kind of regular pronouncements of its death, setting up a challenge to constantly renew itself, painting has risen to the occasion and does all the time because of this kind of sideways or ability to connect to other forms.
Let's move sideways here in your studio. There's one painting that I'm really taken by from the distance, these great kind of pinks coming out at me, pink and grey and blue. It's a beauty.
This painting here is an abstracted version of a landscape, similar to those mountains from Renaissance paintings that I was talking about earlier. And I forget what the source for this was, but I was looking at a figure of a monk wearing a brown habit, kind of doing stuff in the setting. And I wasn't so interested in which monk it was or what the story was, but what I found interesting was that there seemed to be a visual correlation between the stylistic way that the mountains were painted and the folds in his cloth on his arm and his elbow and stuff. And the whole painting, despite the narrative overload in the original, really depended very much on this kind of connection between that swirling cloth movement and the mountain, and the fact that he was differentiated from the background by a kind of purple mountains versus the brown habit. And in a way, some of these other paintings are doing something similar. Like that one there is based on a Pusan, which is of several figures involved in some mythological tale. But what interested me was just the vibrancy of the color of the figures against a more muted natural background. And that one over there is a further sort of abstraction of a real classical painting by Poussin of an assumption. So we've got the Blessed Virgin, all the saints and the angels. They're ascending to the heavens. And the colors that he used are bright cerulean blue, reds, yellows, really dark colors against this kind of golden sunlight. And I just thought I would like to make that and reference not just the classical world, but a world where blobs of color against a neutral background are something that is really familiar to us. It's part of the bread and butter of modern art.
A painting again that's taken my eye behind us, this, and we're talking about shape and color in painting, but this beautiful, there's a sense of strong sense of clouds in a landscape, but the shapes somehow, they certainly do something to me as a viewer that I can't quite put my finger on, but it's somehow something primal.
Yeah, I mean, the painting originally comes again from a Poussin painting, which would have had loads of figures flying around in these clouds, like the angels and the saints, you know, cavorting as they do in clouds. But what I was interested in was the sense in which almost like the weight of the clouds seemed to be bearing down on the landscape.
Yes,
and it seemed as if it was being supported by the trees as well. So it's like there's this crushing event of nature happening, which is an altogether different sort of narrative than the narrative maybe of the figures within the Poussin painting.
Is it hard to make a painting? Is it from the idea to realizing it, to actually putting oil on a canvas and working that through?
I think it's really difficult to make paintings. And even though I've been doing it for probably 40 years, it's like every time I begin, every time I go to do it, it's almost like starting completely from the beginning. There's a sense in which the experience that you gain from doing things over and over again seems to desert you once you start on a blank canvas.
And of course, we have the sounds of Temple Bar in the background. Robert, thanks a million.
Robert Armstrong's show opens at the Kevin Kavanagh Gallery in Dublin on Thursday next, January the 16th, and that publication, Generation, 30 Years of Creativity, at Temple Bar Gallery and Studios, is available through most art galleries and shops. Join us again in a moment for the music and words of the remarkable American pianist and composer Ahmad Jamal. Aftermath there, an original piece from American pianist and composer Ahmad Jamal, who plays at Vicker Street in Dublin on Friday, January the 24th. That's from a live concert in Paris to mark his 70th birthday in 2000. Jamal is regarded as one of the most influential figures in jazz and is one of the great survivors from a generation of great musicians. He himself prefers to call jazz American classical music and has been a driving force in that music for over 60 years. Greatly admired by Miles Davis, he's celebrated for his reinterpretations of American standards, but also for a significant body of original composition and a unique style that seems to give space and breadth to the music. Billy O'Hanlon, Ahmad Jamal, quite a unique figure in American music, in jazz music. What's so distinctive, so special about his style and about his status?
Well, he created a style within the 50s that had an emphasis on space and also on silence. There might seem like unusual characteristics within music, but he emerges at a time in the mid-50s when the kind of the bebop movement was very interested in sort of pyrotechnics and playing as many, you know, variations on chord changes as possible. And he simplified things without compromising any of his own artistic integrity. So he also, he came from Pittsburgh and he was very influenced by piano players like Errol Garner, who some of our listeners might know from the famous tune Misty. And Garner had this kind of orchestral conception of the piano, almost creating a huge sound on the solo piano. And in a way, what Jamal did was he pruned this down into a very, very kind of minimal sound, and with these great emphasis on allowing the, you know, the spaces to breathe between the notes. And then his influence, I suppose, was also in his choice of repertoire, that he drew a lot on popular American songs like Surrey the Fringe on Top from Oklahoma, and songs like Billy Boy, and he then influenced a lot of other artists, in that a lot of other jazz artists started to cover tunes like this. Also, he was quite responsible for popularizing tunes like Autumn Leaves.
So in a sense, what he did as well was to bring jazz into popular music culture. And as when you look at the American charts in the 50s, what he did was quite remarkable, because it was a pretty closed shop, and he seemed to have helped break through all of that.
Well, what's amazing about the American charts in the 50s, I mean, you have the advent of the LP record, and this was an absolutely new format. So the charts are absolutely, would be unrecognizable to us today, that you had classical music, country and western music, jazz, all vying for, you know, positions within the charts. So in a way, the 50s was a golden age for music, that, you know, you could turn on the radio or go down to your local record shop, and in the top 10 you could find a jazz record. And so he belongs to a certain school of jazz artists like Dave Brubeck, Oscar Peterson, who kind of crossed over into great popular success without in any way compromising their own integrity.
A great city in terms of his performance and the recording, Chicago, and his performances at the Pershing Club in Chicago in the 50s. Legendary performances, and a great, great album. It was a classic album from that time.
Well, Live at the Pershing is one of the great live jazz albums, although he himself likes to call them remote recordings, because he said many times that all music is recorded live. But by remote, he means actually bringing the recording equipment right into the club and capturing that kind of ephemeral moment, because jazz is a very ephemeral art, and that's why nothing kind of really beats the live experience of the club. So this album, Live at the Pershing, became a massive selling album, stayed in the charts for nearly 2 years. Again, it's inconceivable that a jazz album would enter the charts today and stay there for 2 years.
Billy, you talked about his interpretation of standards, and of course that track, the Surrey with the Fringe on Top from Oklahoma. Let's have a listen to that from that album, Live at the Pershing. Abba Jamal there with a rather different version of the Surrey with the Fringe on Top. Billy, how is Jamal regarded by other jazz musicians? I mean, he's one of the great survivors, and one of the people who was a tremendous admirer of him was Miles Davis.
Well, Miles at the same time as Jamal was coming to the fore, was recently signed to Columbia Records. And Miles, of course, had been profoundly involved in the bebop revolution and had played trumpet with Charlie Parker. And around this time, Miles is looking for a new sound. He's looking at trying to, I suppose, play a less complicated form of music. And he found his inspiration in a lot of the playing of Jamal. And he loved Jamal's, again, his use of silence and space. And he sent both of his piano players, Red Garland and Bill Evans, along to the Pershing Club to listen to Jamal. And Miles was so taken by Jamal's music that he started to record not only Jamal's own compositions, but also to include a lot of the standard tunes that Jamal was playing. And the first of his big collaborations with the Gil Evans Orchestra, Miles Ahead, he plays a tune called New Rumba, which was composed by Jamal. And Jamal's piano playing style was to have a huge influence on, I suppose, Miles' most famous piano collaborator, Bill Evans, who was to take a lot of Jamal's style and bring it even further.
Ahmad Jamal's New Rumba there, in a version by Miles Davis and the Gil Evans Orchestra from the album Miles Ahead. Well, I've been talking to Ahmad Jamal in advance of his Irish concert. I asked him if those first notes played at the age of 3 brought him into his creative life in music, to the beginning of it all.
The very beginning, absolutely. At 3 years old. Amazing.
And was it in some way like a language that was already inside you, and one that you nurtured and that has grown and expanded with you over the years?
I think there was a great deal of gift, if not 100%, maybe 1,000%. Absolutely.
Gift, and I'm sure a great deal of hard work and determination as well.
Well, you still have to work at it, even at 83, I just finished looking at my piano and going through a few notes, because you have to keep at it. You have to exercise. It's like you have to exercise the body if you can, and you have to feed the body every day. So you have to also take care of the music. If you're a saxophonist or a trumpet player or a pianist, you have to do it every day if you can. Sometimes the pace of today's world doesn't allow you, but you have to take time to continue to discover. That's the whole thing, to discover new things. You must make discoveries, whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, or an Indian chief. You must always make discovery. So that's what it's all about, discovering new things every day.
What inspires your own original composition? And I know that now forms the greater part of your repertoire in concert.
Well, in order to discover, you have to be in tune with life. You don't discover anything if you're out of tune. There's a lot of people walking around that are dead, and they don't discover anything. So you have to be very, very careful, because if you're not, you won't discover anything. Whether you're a scientist, doctor, or journalist, or newspaper reporter, doesn't make any difference. A radio commentator, if you're not in tune, you're not going to make the right commentary. So you have to be in tune with what's going on in order to discover. You have to be very careful.
Speaking of radio commentators, the great pianist and composer and radio host, Marion McPartland, who died last year at 95, believed that music has associated colours. And she said that the key of D is daffodil yellow and B major is maroon and B flat is blue. And I love that concept. You know, it's quite beautiful and poetic. And I wonder, do you see colour at all in your music?
I see many things in my music. I see joy, I see laughter, I see sadness. There are many things, more than just color. There are many things. I knew Marion. I did her show, and we've known each other for years, and she was quite a lady.
She was. She seemed to be a remarkable person. I mean, again, one of these people I wish I'd met somewhere along the way. As indeed I wish, I suppose, like many people, that I had the chance to meet Miles Davis. You know, I'm sure you're probably tired of answering questions about Davis. I know you greatly admired each other, and you've said before that you were both leaders, you know, forging your own way and your own distinct music and vision. Does he remain for you in some quiet way, a personal inspiration still?
Well, it's a mutual admiration society. Miles is a forger and a trend maker, and we admired each other, and we never hung out. But it's quality, not quantity. You can be with a person constantly, and you have not a quality relationship. So Miles and I lived a block and a half away from each other in New York City, but we didn't hang out. We had a lot of respect. The last time I saw Miles was in somewhere in Europe, at the Fuji Festival in Finland, I think, somewhere, wherever it is. And that's the last time I saw him. But we respected each other, and he continues to sell records and to grow in the minds of people all over the world, which is a great tribute to Miles Davis. And I admire his work.
I think that you prefer to call jazz American classical music, and one can see many of the reasons for that. I wonder, in general, is there still something of an elitist attitude towards what we call jazz in the US? You know, an attitude that places opera or European and Russian classical music above Parker and Miles and you and all the rest of it in some imagined order of importance.
Yeah, you got it, exactly. Well put. Congratulations. Well put, Vincent. Absolutely. There's a piece of software called jazz for a computer. It has nothing to do with music. There are many definitions of jazz that have nothing to do with music in the dictionary. But I'm not paranoid about the word jazz, but what we've done with sophisticated art form to the extent that people all over the world come to learn about this form. People from all parts of the world, China, from Japan, from Russia, all over the world to learn about the Earl Garners and the Duke Ellingtons and the Sidney Bechets and so forth and so on. But what it is, it's American classical music. In my opinion, that's what I call it. I don't call myself a jazz artist. I don't think Duke Ellington called himself a jazz artist. He was the great Duke, and I shared a concert stage with him on his 25th anniversary in Carnegie Hall when I was only 22 years old. So on that bill was Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Stan Getz, Billie Holiday, and myself. I'm the only one living from the headliners. And they were very influential the world over. So they were American classical musicians and artists. They made up the American classical music community, as Gershwin did, and as Paul Whiteman did, and as Jimmy Lunsford did, so forth and so on. I'm not paranoid about the word, but I don't call it jazz.
And I think I see exactly why. Let's give things the proper names at times. It's actually very interesting. I know there are many theories about the origin of that word jazz, and one that I'm very fond of, whether it's true or not, is that it actually comes from Irish, from the Irish language, from Gaelic. It has Irish workers on the railways hearing this great music for the first time and saying good jazz, which means lovely or fine or great. And it strikes me that there's certainly a shared heartbeat between some of this great music of your country, of America, and of Ireland.
No, that's very interesting. That when it's good, it's universal. Anything that's good, whether it's food or music, it belongs to the world.
Speaking of the world and the bigger world, I know that France has been very important to you, and the French seem to have a deep appreciation and understanding of what you do. How important are those international links and contexts for you, both as a composer and performer?
Well, it has a wonderful historic background. You had Sidney Bechet, who left the United States years and years and years ago, and never went back. You have Johnny Griffin, who left the United States, settled in France, and Bud Powell, who left, and Dexter Gordon, so many who left the United States and went to other areas to share their expertise. And what happens sometimes, the person is not appreciated to the extent that they're appreciated in other places. Sometimes a person is not appreciated in his or her own hometown. And that's very unfortunate, but it happens that way, whether it's Mozart or whether it's me. So I have a very historic appreciation for other parts of the world that enjoy my music, including Istanbul and France in particular, where I'm a member of the Officer of the Order of Arts and Letters. The French government made me an officer in the Order of Arts and Letters, but I've received accolades here as well. I'm an NEA master, and that's a very, very special position to be elected into the United States. So I appreciate all of my awards all over the world, in France in particular.
People who come along to Vicar Street in Dublin here on the 24th of January, what can they look forward to?
Well, they can look forward to Ahmed Jamal and his presentation he's been doing for a number of years, something new and something old and something different. Two things, something new, something old, and something different.
Snowfall by Ahmed Jamal, and before that, Jamal himself. Billy O'Hanlon, you could really hear the spirit of the man in that interview.
Absolutely, and how steeped in the history of this music, the, as he calls it, American classical music he is. I mean, even going back to Pittsburgh, where he was born, I mean, he really was born at a pivotal time. He was born in 1930, and he comes from a town, you know, that's absolutely full of this music, and such a big lineage of the music within his own hometown. People like Earl Garner, Earl Hines, Art Blakey, and the great Duke Ellington arranger Billy Strayhorn. So, I mean, it's quite like our own Irish traditional music, with all these different regional styles, because the traditional narrative you'll read in many jazz history books that it all started in New Orleans, and it's much more complex than that. And also, I mean, his sense of heritage in that is really phenomenal.
And the passion as well for, you know, for the music, but also his absolute determination that this is American classical music and that it should be called that.
That's very important, because I think in so often it's been kind of sidelined as just a part of the entertainment industry, and often a lot of the historians of the music have in fact been kind of if you want, white people writing about black people's music. And most of the great jazz artists have often had a very ambiguous relationship with the word jazz. Miles used to just call it the music. Duke Ellington used to also refer to it as American classical music. In a way, jazz, you know, it's a kind of a sexy word, and it sort of has nightclub connotations. When, if you actually consider the artistry of these people, it's something much bigger than that. And his point as well about his relationship with France. France was always this, you know, a place of refuge for these artists. And does so many heartbreaking stories of American jazz players being greeted as, you know, profoundly as artists and embraced by the intellectuals of Europe. And then when they'd return to New York or whatever city they came from, you know, suddenly playing back in dive nightclubs and often being, you know, harassed by police and that kind of thing. So that's a very important point he makes there.
Of course, he's one of the great survivors, still making music, still recording albums. And in a moment, we'll hear track from his latest album, Saturday Morning. But, you know, it will, I think, be a great concert.
Absolutely. And I mean, the word legend and the word seminal are often thrown around lightly like confetti by music journalists. But I think in the case of Jamal, it applies in spades, because here is a man who, you know, when people are in Vicker Street on that night, there will be a 1 degree of separation between the audience and really the whole pantheon of jazz history. And that's no exaggeration.
Billy O'Hanlon, thanks very much indeed. And that's it from us. Ahmad Jamal plays Vicker Street in Dublin on January the 24th. We leave you with a track, Silver, paying tribute, I think, to another of the great jazz
Horace
musicians,
Silver.
Horace Silver, from Jamal's latest album, Saturday Morning. From all of us, good night.